This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, June 5th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. After 6 years of Republican control, power in the Senate begins to switch back to the Democrats. The U.S. Civil Rights Commission says Florida's November election disenfranchised minorities at a rate 10 times that of whites.
But they're only at the tip of the iceberg. Like, for example, the 20 out of 67 counties that didn't even do their mandatory machine recount that involves 1,800,000 Floridians.
And is the wood used in playground sets, picnic tables, and home decks tainted with arsenic, as one environmental group claims?
A typical five-year-old who played on a playset with the average level of arsenic found in our sampling would, in less than 2 weeks, receive a lifetime acceptable dose of arsenic, according to the federal definitions of cancer risk.
But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. An advance copy of the report by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights was made available today. The draft of the report concludes minority voters were unjustly penalized by the way Florida conducted the 2000 presidential election, and it specifically criticizes the president's brother, Governor Jeb Bush, and his state campaign manager, Florida's Secretary of State, Katherine Harris. Two Republican members of the 8-member commission say that the early release is politically motivated, trying to diminish the importance of the panel's complete findings. The full report is due on Friday. President Bush ended his trip through Florida today and headed back to Washington, D.C. to meet with some senior senators. Ellen Ratner reports from the Capitol.
Making nice at the White House this afternoon, President Bush met with several members of the Senate concerning his education bill. Included in this meeting were Senator Jeffords and Senator Kennedy. Mentioning Senator Jeffords, the president said there would be a give and take on the education bill. Asked by reporters about the Mideast situation, he replied that he thought the Mitchell report was a very good report and that step one was to stop the violence. He said, "It is important to build confidence in the region." At the White House for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ellen Ratner.
There's some confusion today over announced ceasefires in the Middle East. Raphael Kraft reports from the Gaza Strip.
The word ceasefire was on the Palestinian agenda today. Fatah organization said it would follow Yasser Arafat's course of action. But the declaration issued by the Palestinian main political party this morning is fuzzy. The ceasefire will be respected if Israel is ready to dismantle its colonies in the occupied territories. It is to note that the Mitchell report does not specify a full retreat of Israeli occupation forces, but a construction freeze in the existing colonies. Both Hamas and Islamic Jihad fundamentalist movements keep applauding the suicide bomb attack in Tel Aviv last Friday. In the meantime, the Israeli government has just issued a list of 300 people, most of whom are members of Fatah, Hamas, and Islamic Jihad, to be put back in jail by the Palestinian Authority, a measure Yasser Arafat could doubtly implement. Indeed, the street of Gaza is almost unanimous in thinking that the Intifada should be carried on. The Palestinian people were commemorating the 34th anniversary of Israeli occupation in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip today. The distance in between the reality on the field and both Israeli and Palestinian declarations is so big and obvious that there is no reason to think that the Palestinian people are ready to bend its knees and obey the Western world in Israeli's diktat. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in the Gaza Strip.
Obtaining affordable health care is apparently a problem for health care workers, too. And it's one reason nurses are striking in Minnesota. From Minneapolis, Caitlin Pine reports.
On Sunday, 1,500 nurses walked off their jobs at two hospitals in the Minneapolis area. In what could have been the nation's largest nursing strike, only two nursing staffs out of the 10 hospitals voted to strike. Nurses are also demanding lower health care premiums and higher pay. Joanne Dish, an associate professor of nursing at the University of Minnesota, says that there have been warning signs of a possible strike.
The nurses for a long time feel they have been raising concerns. The hospital administrators feeling their backs to the wall because of external pressures for cost. And there just haven't been sufficient compromise strategies.
The group's union, the Minnesota Nurses Association, had recommended ratification for the last-minute contracts offered by the hospitals. But the contracts that most nurses settled for did not include assurances for lower health care premiums and final say on patient workload. The 1,500 nurses on strike are holding out for those conditions. For Free Speech Radio, I'm Caitlin Pine.
And finally, today is World Environment Day. To mark the occasion, the United Nations unveiled an ambitious effort to map the health of the world's ecosystems. From the United Nations, Susan Wood reports.
The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment is a $21 million four-year study involving 1,500 of the world's leading scientists. It will examine the impact of human activity on natural systems that support life, such as forests, farmlands, and oceans. Damage to ecosystems in many parts of the world has already diminished their capacity to meet human needs for food and clean water. The assessment will build on a five-volume pilot analysis published in 2000 and produced by the World Resources Institute, UN agencies, and the World Bank. Speakers at the news conference launching the study said it exemplifies the type of public-private partnerships the UN is increasingly seeking to build. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Susan Wood at the United Nations.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today is the last day Republicans will have control of the U.S. Senate. The shifting of power back to the Democrats after a six-year Republican majority comes as a result of Vermont Senator James Jeffords' decision last month to leave the Republican Party and vote as an independent. Jeffords' explanation for abandoning the GOP ranks was based on his principles. His moderate politics, he said, had no place within the grand old party. Now, with one vote less than a majority, power switches to the Democrats, who will set the tone and the direction of the powerful congressional body. It's expected to have broad implications on both sides of the aisle and at the White House. But as Adam Sharon reports, consumer advocate Ralph Nader suspects it'll translate into more of the same.
With the power shift in the United States Senate from Republican to Democratic-controlled, there is a mood in Washington of either extreme sadness or extreme joy, depending on the person's political affiliation. One Washingtonian, however, is markedly blasé about the entire ordeal. Chastising the Democratic Party, consumer advocate and former Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader addressed a gathering at the National Press Club today in Washington, D.C. Nader, continuing with his campaign themes, rebuked Democrats for not distinguishing their political agenda from that of the Republican Party.
My position is that there are differences between the two parties, but they're not different enough. Their convergence and fundamental similarities on the structure of power in our country represent a level that invites people to ask whether there is a flunk grade for these two parties, below which, when they fall below that flunk rate, it's time to do something much more fundamental than to simply settle for the least worst every 4 years.
Nader in particular expressed his outrage over the imbalance of wealth and prosperity in the United States. The working class, lamented Nader, have not benefited from this period of economic growth, while the wealthiest 1% of Americans continue to get rich.
Usually where there's economic growth, it's a tide that raises all boats. At the present time, it seems to be a tide that raises all yachts.
This speech follows last week's analysis by the Center for Budget and Priorities on the inequity of the Bush tax plan. From Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Adam Sharon.
An advance copy of the report by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights was reported today. In it, the draft concludes that African-American voters were unusually penalized by the way Florida conducted the 2000 presidential election. The report specifically criticizes Governor Jeb Bush and Secretary of State Katherine Harris. Two Republican members of the commission say the early release is politically motivated and disavow its conclusions. The report's release comes ironically as President Bush ended a two-day swing through Florida today. The president was in Tampa this morning praising one of his prime concerns, faith-based initiatives, as he worked on a Habitat for Humanity house. Last night, he spoke to thousands about his signature domestic issue, tax cuts. But Mitch Perry reports that hundreds who protested the president last night cared little about their government check, but more about the president's environmental policies in Florida.
Well, President Bush was touting the virtues of Habitat for Humanity this morning. A lone dissenter, Bob Kunst, said the civil rights report calling Florida officials grossly derelict for their part in last year's presidential election doesn't go nearly far enough.
I testified before this commission on when they were in Miami, but they're only at the tip of the iceberg. When they first had their two meetings in Tallahassee and Miami, there's been so much more evidence that's come out. Like, for example, the 20 out of 67 counties that didn't even do their mandatory machine recount that involves 1,800,000 Floridians. That just came out in the Washington Post last week.
Last night, the president basked in the adulation of thousands in Legends Field, the spring training home of the New York Yankees. The president has campaigned for his tax cut for well over a year, both during the presidential campaign and has fought even harder for it since being inaugurated in January. The president used Florida to crow about his largest success in his presidency so far.
6 months ago, it was supposed to be a political liability. Today, folks, tax relief is reality. I have the honor of signing the largest tax relief bill in 20 years.
But Bob Poe from the Florida Democratic Party said the president's speech last night was an insult for those that he professed to help today with Habitat for Humanity.
It's interesting that the first he comes over here to talk about the tax cut and the checks in the mail. Then he goes over to Habitat for Humanity to do a little show and tell to the people who are never going to get a check in the mail. Those are the folks who need it the most, and they're not going to benefit from this tax cut whatsoever.
This was Bush's third appearance in Florida since the election, but his first outside of the heavily conservative Northern Panhandle section. Bush began his foray into Florida Monday morning with an appearance at the Everglades National Park. He was greeted by protesters from the Sierra Club, angered by recent news that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld had recently written a letter to then-Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman John Warner to revisit the issue of allowing an airport to be built at the former Homestead Air Force Base, which was devastated in 1992 by Hurricane Andrew. In January, environmentalists thought they had won a victory when the Air Force announced that they would not allow an airport to be built at Homestead, which would be situated between both the Everglades and Biscayne National Park. The Sierra Club's Beth Connor said that this issue is not acceptable to Floridians.
It's another flip-flop, and the president flip-flopped on this oil drilling issue four times during his campaign. He said he would stand with his brother and not support offshore oil drilling, and he said that he would not touch the record of decision on Homestead Air Force Base, and then we find out that Rumsfeld has written this letter.
And Connor said she was mystified as to why the president was talking about tax cuts and not the environment.
It actually kind of makes me question why he can't kind of get in sync with what's going on. And obviously that passed and no one asked for it. And I think that he's really off base, or his advisors are very off base, putting him in Legends Field to talk about tax cuts that nobody wanted, no one asked for, and we're all screaming about offshore oil drilling.
Protester Dave Cutler said he is of a solid group of Democrats in the state who still don't believe that Bush won Florida or the White House last year. He says he's not ready to get over it.
I don't accept him as my president. I never will accept him as my president. Frankly, I know people are telling me to get over it. I will get over it when, on January 20th of 2005, when we have a real, legitimate Democratic president in the White House.
Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Los Angeles mayoral candidates James Hahn and Antonio Villagrosa campaigned vigorously on the eve of the election. Both candidates are trying to win over any undecided voters in an extremely close race. A recent Los Angeles Times poll showed Hahn leading by 7 percentage points. Laura Hoffer reports.
The candidates are both Democrats, and their positions on many important issues like affordable housing and public transportation are similar. But Hahn claims it is his experience in government and ability to get things done that distinguishes him from his opponent.
Now, the difference between the two of us may not be that great on issues, people say. I want to have more housing. He wants to have more housing. I want to put more buses on the street and have a better transportation. So does he. I think the real difference is experience. I've been a city controller for 4 years. I've been city attorney for 16 years.
But there's another significant difference. Candidate Jim Hahn is popular among African-American voters, while Villagrosa enjoys the support of Latino voters. Hahn's popularity in the African-American community is partly due to the legacy of his father, a well-loved Los Angeles County supervisor who represented a mostly black district. A Los Angeles Times poll showed Hahn carrying 74% of black voters. One of his final rallies included Magic Johnson and black elected officials Maxine Waters and Yvonne Brathwaite Burke. He also has the support of the Los Angeles Police Union and appeals to more conservative voters, Republicans, older voters, and residents of the suburban San Fernando Valley, while Villaraigosa appeals to younger and liberal West Side voters. But Villaraigosa's strongest support comes from the Latino population. He carries 57% of the Latino vote to Hahn's 27% in the LA Times poll. Juan Jimenez is president of Operation Yes, a nonprofit anti-gang organization serving the East Los Angeles Latino community where Villaraigosa grew up. He says he supports Villaraigosa both for his Latino heritage and his ability to bring the city together.
So I believe that we got to get a better leadership, and I believe that it is now for history to allow a Hispanic person who is sensitive, who loves everybody, and shares without prejudice.
Nancy Snow, Associate Director at the Center of Communication and Community at UCLA, says despite the efforts of the candidates to reach out beyond their demographic strengths, voting will likely fall into a predictable pattern.
It may very well turn out that you'll see these distinguished voting blocks, and I think as much as we talk, we pay lip service to LA being the most diverse city and so multicultural, we're still very much separated culturally, racially, ethnically.
With the polling numbers so tight, both candidates are talking about building coalitions in the final speeches of their campaigns. Jim Hahn in a speech at a last-minute rally.
I put together a coalition in this campaign that's unmatched. I have more support in more communities than any other candidate for mayor has ever had. And it's because people know over and over again that Jim Hahn will represent all of us.
Antonio Villaraigosa shared a very similar sentiment.
It's been a campaign of hope. It's been a campaign of bringing people together. At every turn when people have tried to make a big thing that I'd be the first, I said, hold it. I think what I represent is an opening up of this city. I think what I represent is a new model for leadership, a model for leadership that's as comfortable in Brentwood as he is in Bola Heights.
But the candidates are not being so conciliatory with each other. Hahn is accusing Villaraigosa of having the support of what Hahn calls billionaires and big party bosses. Villaraigosa accuses Hahn of racism and compares him to Joseph McCarthy and Sam Yorty, a former Los Angeles mayor who successfully defeated black opponent Tom Bradley by falsely connecting him to the radical black power movement in the 60s. Hahn produced a commercial criticizing Villaraigosa for writing a letter to the White House on behalf of a convicted cocaine trafficker. The commercial contained images of the letter along with a crack pipe and a razor cutting cocaine. This is Laura Hawther in Los Angeles for Free Speech Radio News.
The Washington Supreme Court heard arguments in a domestic partnership case against the city of Vancouver, Washington. In 1998, the city voted to allow domestic partners of city employees to have the same health benefits as legally sanctioned spouses. But a group of Christian conservatives has helped file a lawsuit against the city's benefit program. In 1994, the same group won the right in federal Supreme Court for veterans groups to exclude gays, lesbians, and bisexuals from parades. The implications of the court's decision could impact municipal rights in Washington, the Washington legislature, and other pending domestic partnership cases in the U.S. Thatcher Collins reports from Washington Capital City, Olympia.
We represent Mrs. Ronnie Heinzma. She's a resident of Vancouver and a taxpayer. She opposes giving benefits to domestic partners, to unmarried couples.
Jordan Lawrence argued the case before the Washington State Supreme Court.
Same-sex and opposite-sex couples are covered by this. To elevate cohabiting couples to the level of marriage and say that they're all equivalent, she views as a wrong thing and a ultimately corrosive to society to do something like that.
Funding this lawsuit is the Alliance Defense Fund, or ADF, founded by a collection of conservative groups including James Dobson's Focus on the Family. They have funded lawsuits against laws and ordinances on domestic partnerships and same-sex marriages in Hawaii, Vermont, Pennsylvania, Alaska, Virginia, Ohio, Massachusetts, Florida, and New York. The ADF calls benefits to domestic partners sex subsidies and advocates against all marriage alternatives. Under the terms of the ordinance, Vancouver will spend about $20,000 this year for health care for 30 of the partners of city employees. They are competing with the many corporations who extend benefits to domestic partners. Any taxpayer in Vancouver can challenge a ruling as an unfair tax burden. Lawrence argued that the City of Vancouver's definition of dependence is contradictory.
Somebody with a sick grandmother who is 100% financially dependent on a city employee cannot be covered. This is not recognizing a broad spectrum of family diversity, but a very narrow, and I would say politically correct, slice of diversity.
Vancouver's lawyer, Deborah Quinn, sees as the issue municipal rights to regulate within the state's open definition of dependent. Vancouver's anti-discrimination laws make domestic partnerships their first priority over other potential dependents. Quinn talked about the direct and indirect implications of this case.
As far as domestic partner benefits in the state of Washington and the ability of municipalities to provide those, this case will set the precedent. As far as whether the state could provide domestic partner benefits, this case may have some bearing, but it will not set precedents for that. We lost the case because we needed to further define the definition of dependence, continue to provide domestic partner benefits. If we lost the case because the court said that the city has no authority whatsoever to provide domestic partner benefits, then obviously we would not be able to provide them anymore.
And if Vancouver loses the case, a similar Seattle ordinance might fall. Currently, the Supreme Court is also deciding the Vasquez v. Hawthorne case, which will establish how to determine shared property rights and responsibilities after one partner dies. Anytime a court establishes a manner of verifying a domestic partnership, it will bear on other domestic partnership cases. The case could also become a point of reference outside of Washington, along with Virginia's Supreme Court decision against Arlington County. That there is even an issue depends on legislative acquiescence. In 1997, after overturning Governor Gary Locke's veto, the legislature enacted the Defense of Marriage Act, but the legislature refused to ban domestic partnerships. This case could have its greatest impact on the legislature by ending acquiescence and bringing the issue of domestic partnerships to a referendum. I'm Thatcher Collins for Free Speech Radio News in Olympia.
The wood in most playground sets, picnic tables, and decks contains potentially hazardous levels of the same poison at the center of the debate over the safety of America's drinking water, arsenic. That's according to a new report out by the Environmental Working Group. Kelia Ramirez has more.
Chromated copper arsenate, CCA, which is 22% pure arsenic by weight, is the most common wood preservative in the United States. It's intended to protect wood against insects and fungi. CCA-treated wood is used in basically any outdoor use of lumber except wooden roof shingles. Bill Walker, California director of the Environmental Working Group, calls arsenic in wooden playground equipment a greater threat to children than arsenic in drinking water.
What our study has found is that kids particularly are more likely to be exposed to unsafe levels of arsenic through playground equipment than through drinking water. In fact, a typical five-year-old who played on a playset with the average level of arsenic found in our sampling would in less than 2 weeks receive a lifetime acceptable dose of arsenic according to the federal definitions of cancer risk.
People can be exposed to arsenic and not know it because it is tasteless, colorless, and odorless. The Environmental Protection Agency and the World Health Organization have classified arsenic as a known human carcinogen. The National Research Council concluded in 1999 that there is evidence to link arsenic with immune system suppression and increased risks of high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. Children are particularly susceptible to arsenic leaching from treated wood because they are smaller, have less well-developed organs for excreting toxins, and can ingest more toxins than adults by frequently putting their hands into their mouths while playing. Walker says the wood preservative industry is not doing enough to warn or protect consumers.
The voluntary measures that the wood industry and the people who sell the wood have pushed to try and avoid banning the stuff also aren't working. When you go into Home Depot or Lowe's or whatever and buy wood that's treated with arsenic, they're supposed to provide you with a warning sheet that says, you know, these are the dangers of playing on or around this wood. Well, we found in sort of spot checking coast to coast that information is almost never provided. And in fact, Lowe's and Home Depot don't even stock alternatives to arsenic-treated wood.
Mike Green, executive director of the Center for Environmental Health, explains why arsenic is still being used to treat wood in the United States, even though it is banned in Europe.
The issue is not the science. The issue is politics. And so there's been an exemption that has been passed through federally here that has allowed the arsenic to continue to be used here in the states. So, for example, 50% of arsenic used for commercial purposes in the entire world is used here in the U.S. for pressure treating wood. So you can't use it in pesticides, but you can use it on children's decks.
According to Jan Stensland Patton, a consultant with a background in architecture, architects can specify alternatives to arsenic-treated wood without significantly raising the costs of the project.
The other alternatives are at par, and depending on where you buy them, you know, if you buy it from sometime a boutique, it might be a little more expensive, but it's not going to make a huge noticeable difference in terms of acquisition. There are other kinds of treated woods that don't have the arsenic in it, like ACQ. And now there's also another one called CBA.
The Environmental Working Group and the Healthy Buildings Network are recommending an immediate ban by the Consumer Product Safety Commission of all CCA-treated wood for use on playground equipment, emergency suspension by the Environmental Protection Agency of CCA as a wood treatment pesticide, and prompt repeal by Congress of the hazardous waste exemption for arsenic-treated wood, which allows the wood to be dumped in unlined landfills or recycled as mulch. The 13-page Poisoned Playgrounds report is available on the web at www.ewg.org. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelly O'Ramaris in Berkeley.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on four continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, go to the strike's website at www.savepacifica.net/strike. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Headlines editor, Randy Zimmerman. Technical producer, Jade Pageant-Seekins. Technical assistant, Matt Martin. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. This newscast was produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa and the Independent Media Center in New York. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.